Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Iti bhagavato devya. Iti bhagavato devya. Iti bhagavato devya. Prati shaptum alantama. Prati shaptum alantama. Prati shaptum alantama. Iti bhagavato devya. Prati shaptum alantama. Mudna sa jagrihe shapam. Mudna sa jagrihe shapam. Mudna sa jagrihe shapam. Etavat sadhu lakshanam. Etavat sadhu lakshanam. Etavat sadhu lakshanam. Mudna sa jagrihe shapam. Etavat sadhu lakshanam. Iti bhagavato devya. Prati shaptum alantama. Mudna sa jagrihe shapam. Etavan sadhu lakshanam. Iti bhagavato devya. Prati shaptum alantama. Mudna sa jagrihe shapam. Etavat sadhu lakshanam. Iti thus bhagavata. The most exalted devotee. It's quite significant here that this word Bhagavata is being used. If we go back a few verses, we can see Lord Shiva spent quite a number of verses glorifying the qualities of Chitraketu, which is quite interesting because, relatively speaking, he's a new devotee. He was only practicing, you know, devotional service for a very short period of time, you know, actually 1 week, and then he saw directly the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he was glorifying the Lord, you know, he received blessings, glorified the Lord. And then for not that long at all, he was a devotee, and here we see that he's being referred to by Sukadeva Goswami as Bhagavata, which is indicating his greatness as a devotee. Devya of Parvati. Prati Shaptum, to make a counter curse. Alantama, able in all respects. Mudna, with his head. Sa, he, Chitraketu. Jagrihe, accepted. Shapam, the curse. Etavat, this much. Sadhu lakshanam, the symptom of a devotee. Translation. The great devotee Chitraketu was so powerful that he was quite competent to curse Mother Parvati in retaliation. But instead of doing so, he very humbly accepted the curse and bowed his head before Lord Shiva and his wife. This is to be very much appreciated as the standard behavior of a Vaishnav. Responsively pleased. The great devotee Chitraketu was so powerful that he was quite competent to curse Mother Parvati in retaliation. But instead of doing so, he very humbly accepted the curse and bowed his head before Lord Shiva and his wife. This is very much to be appreciated as the standard behavior of a Vaishnav. purport. Upon being informed by Lord Shiva, Mother Parvati could understand that she was wrong in cursing Chitraketu. King Chitraketu was so exalted in his character that in spite of being wrongly cursed by Parvati, he immediately descended from his airplane and bowed his head before the mother, accepting her curse. This has already been explained. Narayana para sarve na kutasyana bibhiti. Chitraketu very sportingly felt that since the mother wanted to curse him, he could accept this curse just to please her. This is called sadhu lakshanam, the characteristic of a sadhu or a devotee. As explained by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Trinadapi sunichena tarodi vasa hishnuna, a devotee should always be very humble and meek and should offer all respects to others, especially to superiors. Being protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a devotee is always powerful, but a devotee does not wish to show his power unnecessarily. However, when a less intelligent person has some power, he wants to use it for sense gratification. This is not the behavior of a devotee. So just read the translation again. The great devotee Chitraketu was so powerful that he was quite competent to curse Mother Parvati in retaliation. But instead of doing so, he very humbly accepted the curse and bowed his head before Lord Shiva and his wife. This is very much to be appreciated as the standard behavior of a Vaishnava. So here we see it's that this story is unfolding, and that Chitraketu, he's been cursed by Parvati, and we see as a result of the curse that he takes birth as the demon Vritrasura. But as we've seen in other pastimes, even though he's born in a demon family, demon body, still it's quite possible for him to be a great devotee of the Lord. Interestingly enough, this story goes through many different stages, and there are many very powerful lessons that we can learn from this story. And one thing very nice about stories or histories, it's a very good way of imbibing qualities or understanding the qualities we can adopt. And I felt there were several qualities in this story, or several lessons we could learn from this story to help us in our development as devotees. The first thing that, for me, which was prominent, was we see in the beginning how Chitraketu, he was very much wanting to have a child. And of course we see, like for instance, you look in the Mahabharata, even when Duryodhana, he was so bent on destroying the Pandavas. Yet at the end, when all his brothers were killed, and Ashwatthama, he killed the five sons of Draupadi, and then he brought them to Dhritarashtra when he was about to die, telling him that they were the Pandavas, because he wanted to make him happy. He was telling him a lie because he knew it wasn't the Pandavas, he knew it was the son of the Pandavas. And Dhritarashtra was very disturbed by that. Duryodhana was very disturbed by that, because when he pressed on the head and he felt the head wasn't as hard as iron, he understood it was the sons of Pandu. And he was devastated because he knew that the family lineage was finished there. Or at least that's what he... Because he didn't realize that Uttara was pregnant and that she was going to give birth to Abhimanyu's child. But so he was devastated. So it's so ingrained in the consciousness of the Kshatriyas to continue the family lineage, especially the lineage of Bharat, because they were ruling the world. So even we see Chitraketu also, the same thing was for him as a Kshatriya. He was very determined to continue the family lineage. Yet his wives were unable to conceive children. So then by the mercy of Angira Muni, then a child was born. And Angira Muni explained that this, as Maharaj was explaining yesterday, this child will cause happiness and distress for you. And he was saying, the child's going to get sick, things like that. He wasn't very bothered by it. But then the child just caused great disturbance, great lamentation for him when the child died. So we can see from this that, people are thinking that by fulfilling their material desires, they'll be happy. But actually, ultimately, from the fulfillment of material desires, comes more distress. And Prabhupada would often use the example of the motor car. You know, people are thinking with a motor car that they're going to get so much happiness by having these nice, you know, fancy cars, and they spend hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars on a motor car these days. And they're thinking it's going to be, you know, there's one motor car you can buy. My son's into cars, so we often have a little bit of motor car Qatar. And we're reading about this one car that's made by a company called Ferrari. And it's such a special car that you can buy the car, you pay $3 million for it, and you can drive it once a year. Because they keep it in the factory, and they'll only let you drive it once a year because there's all these top secret designs and things that they don't want other manufacturers to find out about. But then Prabhupada was, he often talked about the motor car and how, you know, people are thinking, oh, I have this car and I'll get so much satisfaction, I'll be able to drive here, there, you know, go so much faster. And he says, and then they drive, you know, 100 kilometers to go to work every day, then 100 kilometers to come back at night. And they think this is happiness. But it's understood that a person's actually happy when he doesn't have to leave his village to work. Yeah? I was just down in town yesterday, and there's a tailor there my wife regularly goes to. And he's a Bengali man, so I understand a little bit of Bengali, so I can have a conversation with him. And so right next to his shop, I mean, actually he's got the front door of the shop, but the side door of the shop, you go out the side door, and there's a temple there with Radha Krishna, Radha Madan Mohan. And I was thinking, this man is so fortunate, you know, right here where he works, he's got, you know, there's kirtan going on all day long, he can just step out there and take darshan of the deities. You know, this is a fortunate situation. It's like they don't have to travel. You know, they don't have to travel to go to work, they don't have to travel to go to worship the deity or see the Lord. Whereas, you know, you know, in the West, you know, outside of, even in India these days, but, you know, in the West, generally speaking, people are traveling such a great distance to work, even if they're only just going down the road. You know, it can take you 2-3 hours in traffic just to go a few kilometers. You know, and they're thinking this is advancement. But I remember reading an interesting statistic many years ago, that in London, in the days of the horse and cart, the average speed of traffic in London was 12 kilometers an hour. Now in London, we have so many nice roads and traffic lights and so many fast cars. You know, you can get cars now that can do, you know, 250, 360 kilometers an hour. But interestingly enough, the average speed of traffic in London from one side to the other is 12 kilometers an hour. So after all this endeavor, after all this suffering, you know, I mean, and there's so much suffering comes from automobiles. I mean, how many people die on the roads every year? In India alone, 120,000 people a year die as a result of automobiles. It's a phenomenal statistic. You know, and in every country around the world, they've got statistics about how many people die every year as a result of automobiles. You know, so, you know, there's a great amount of suffering just for this notion that they're going to get some enjoyment. And exactly the same thing's happened here with Chitraketu. Just with this notion that he's going to enjoy if he gets a son, so much suffering has come. And that's another important point that's being brought out here in this story, is when the son is killed, then he just becomes immersed in grief. So much so that he gives up his duty. He gives up everything. He's just lying on the floor for days and days and days, just lamenting and crying and just rolling around. And all the queens are rolling around, all the courtesans are rolling, you know, they're all just completely, and the whole kingdom becomes immersed in grief. It reminds me a little story I heard many years ago about Sargal Singh. I don't know if anyone's heard this story about Sargal Singh. Anyhow, there's this man, he's a washerman actually, he had a donkey called Sargal Singh. And his donkey died and he started to lament because his donkey was his way of life, it was his income. And he started to, you know, when Sargal Singh died, he just became immersed in grief. And then other people were saying, oh, this man's immersed in grief, what's going on? He says, oh, Sargal Singh, my best friend, he has died, you know, and all these other people started to get affected by it. And then before long, the whole kingdom was lamenting about the death of Sargal Singh. And then the king came to know about it, and you know, actually one of his advisors came to him and said, oh, did you hear Sargal Singh died? And it's such a calamity, and he was carrying on like this. And then the king said, who's Sargal Singh? I don't know. He said, well, maybe you should find out who Sargal Singh is. So the advisor, he traced it all out, and he actually found out that Sargal Singh was a donkey. And so the whole kingdom was lamenting about the death of the donkey. Yeah. So this is, you know, the nature of this material lamentation. And in the Mahabharata, after Ashwatthama kills the sons of the Pandavas, then Arjuna captures him and he's going to punish him. And then later on, this story is being related to Dhritarashtra by Sanjaya. And then Dhritarashtra, you know, hearing all his sons being killed and hearing that the Pandavas have been killed, he just becomes completely immersed in lamentation. He's rolling around, you know, on the floor. You know, he fell off his throne many times. He's rolling around the floor and Sanjaya picks him up and he falls on the floor again. And he's just lamenting and lamenting and lamenting, just completely lost all his intelligence. And then Sanjaya, because Sanjaya had quite an intimate relationship with Dhritarashtra, he chastised him. And he says, what's the value of grief? What do you gain from grief? You know, he's basically telling him it's a useless thing to do. And he said, you know, he said, only less intelligent people become immersed in grief. And we see Chitraketu is the same. Because he's materialistic, because his endeavor for having his son was material, because he simply wanted to propagate his family, to continue the family line. And because it was material, it's a sign of someone who's less intelligent. And then Sanjaya, he points out to Dhritarashtra, he said that actually the only thing that happens as a result of grief is one gives up their duty. And especially for someone who's more intelligent or interested in higher aims of life, duty is very important. And we see this, you know, all throughout the scriptures, that Mahabharata and the Bhagavatam, so many different places, how great personalities, no matter what calamities face them, they continue with their duty. So this is another thing that's being presented here. We see how that later on, after Chitraketu came to the process of devotional service, he actually became very, very dutiful. That even though all these calamities were coming upon him, you know, you look at Kunti, so many calamities, you know, the Pandavas, so many calamities they were faced. And they were sufficiently powerful. Yudhisthira, at any point in time, he could have told Bhima, he said, kill this person. Because Yudhisthira had no doubt about the nature of Duryodhana and his brothers, especially Dushasana. He had no doubt about how sinful and how covetous they were of the kingdom and the wicked things they were doing to them. You know, Duryodhana tried to poison Bhima. Fed his cousin a poison cake just to kill him, because he thought, if I'm to have this kingdom, he's my biggest obstacle. You know, and they sent them to exile, and during exile, there's one point during the exile, just to show you the dutiful nature of Yudhisthira and how he wouldn't do something to humiliate a member of the family or just another Kshatriya, is when they were in the last year of exile, they were staying by a lake called Dvaitavan, and they were living there with the rishis and that, and Duryodhana came to hear of this, and so then he discussed with Sukuni and Dushasana and Karna, and they always had this wicked intention towards the Pandavas. They always wanted to do the wrong thing by them. So they thought they would come there and embarrass them, you know, see them in their tree bark and skins and stuff like that. And she said, what are you? What sort of Kshatriya are you? You know, you're living here like a savage or something like that. He just really wanted to humiliate them. And so when they came down there, I can't remember the name of the Chitrangada or something was the name of the Gandhava that was there sporting with his wives. And they came down to the lake, the Kauravas, they came, and Chitrangada knew that this is why Duryodhana was coming. And he challenged them. And he actually fought with them, and he captured them. He was going to kill Duryodhana, because he knew that Yudhisthira wouldn't do it because of his nobility. He was a very, very noble person. And so then he was going to kill him, but then Yudhisthira, one of Duryodhana's assistants, ran to Yudhisthira and begged for their help because he knew that he would help him. And Duryodhana was in a very dangerous predicament. And Karna had ran away. And such a brave, brave warrior, he ran away. And so then when Yudhisthira heard this, he immediately sent Bhima and Arjuna to rescue their family members. And Bhima was saying, well, why are you doing this? You know, we don't even have to go and fight. Look, everything's been done for us. They're going to be killed and we can have the kingdom back. And he said, no, I gave my word. We'd go to exile for 13 years. I'll do that. And also, he's a member of the family. How can we stand by while a member of the family is being humiliated like this?
So this is the duty, you know. Even though he could have taken this situation to his advantage, he could have really benefited from this and saved the whole war. But he knew that wasn't his duty to unfairly take advantage. Whereas we see Duryodhana on the other hand, whenever any situation came where he thought he could get advantage from that, he would, even if it was inappropriate. And this is the difference between, as we're saying here, there's a very interesting line. Prabhupada says this is the standard behavior of a Vaishnava. You know, even though Chitraketu, he could have cursed Parvati. And we see that Lord Shiva, there's an interesting discussion in one of the previous verses, which is quoted from Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, where Lord Shiva is pointing out to Parvati, he's giving her a lesson actually. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says he's giving her a lesson, where he's saying that, you know, this is the great power of the Vaishnava. And he's saying to Parvati, actually, you're not a Vaishnava, not like this. And Prabhupada explains that she's actually not a pure devotee. Because why? She's sitting under the banyan tree taking lessons from Lord Shiva in Vaishnava qualities. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, he points out that, you know, this is his power, that even though you cursed him, he didn't react. Thus showing that he's more powerful than you. And so this is one of the other great lessons that is here, is the power of a Vaishnava. So we see that, you know, like out of duty, he just, you know, even though so many calamities were coming, that he just went ahead with whatever he was meant to do, and didn't give it up because of difficulty. And we see that Kunti, you know, she there's that famous prayer that she says to, you know, that let those calamities come in again and again. Because why? Why is she praying like that? She's thinking that, well, whenever these calamities come, I think of Krishna. When I think of Krishna, I no longer face repeated birth and death. Whereas we see the materialist, you know, whenever a calamity comes, someone who, even devotees who have materialistic intentions or materialistic inclination, is that whenever calamities come, they try to solve the calamities. This whole material world is simply moving from one calamity to the next, to the next, to the next. You know, and the calamity right now is global warming. You know, and they're going to try and solve that, but they'll never solve it. I remember listening to a lecture years ago, and Prabhupada was talking about, you know, how people are very keen to try and, you know, change the way the world is. He said, but it will never change because of sinful activities. People are so immersed in sinful activities that, you know, the calamities have to happen. He would say, Prabhupada would say about, you know, they're thinking that their advancement of civilization is how many hospital beds are open. We have more hospital beds, see, we're very, very advanced. He said, but actually this is an indication of their advancement of sinful activities. Because people are sinful, then they get sick. If they're not sinful, they don't have, you know, there's so many diseases these days. And every year we're hearing of a newer and newer disease. You know, and even the simplest of things. You know, I remember, you know, when I was young, you take antibiotics, they were very, very simple. They weren't so powerful, the antibiotics. But now, because the diseases that they're treating with the antibiotics have become more and more powerful, that they have to develop even stronger and stronger antibiotics, and the reactions you get to them are even stronger. Or like when they do these when they murder bugs, they used to just have simple sprays, but now the bugs have actually adapted to it, and they have to come up with more and more powerful poisons to kill them. And even that these poisons are so powerful, you can't even get, you know, you get these things in Australia, you set them off in a room, you can't go into the house for 24 hours because it's so poisonous, it'll kill you. You know, so we find that, you know, all the things that we're coming up with to avert the calamities are actually creating more and more calamities. But the foolish living entity, the foolish scientists, they don't see this. They don't see how all their activities are just the cause of more and more calamities. You know, Like for instance, it was a very big thing a few years ago in America, England, and Australia about this tobacco smoking. These companies are, you know, selling tobacco, and apparently it came out in the courts that the companies had all this information right at the beginning of selling their products, that the product was harmful. If you smoke cigarettes, it would cause cancer, it would cause heart disease, it would cause disease of the arteries, and so many different things. But they concealed it. They suppressed the reports, you know, all the scientific research they'd done. So about I think it was about 5 years ago, this was all discovered. And all these big, big companies were sued and like, you know, the very big court cases. But still, even though there's all this evidence, and you can find on a packet of cigarettes, you know, I know what it's like in other countries, but in Australia, they show pictures, and it's just right, it's bad for your health. They show pictures of people with gangrene, like their feet rotting off, or lungs that have been cut open from someone who's been smoking cigarettes for 20 years and stuff like that. And still, people smoke cigarettes. It's just extraordinary. They know it's killing them. They know it's going to cause them so much pain and suffering. And still they smoke cigarettes. Yeah? And the government's just as foolish, because they tax them. You know, they tax the cigarettes. So, you know, more than half the price of a packet of cigarettes in Australia is from taxes. And they tax the cigarettes, and they know that these people are going to get diseases, and they're going to wind up in hospitals, and the government has to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars, way more than the taxes, dealing with these people's health issues. Because in Australia have free health, so they have to pay for all people's health stuff, you know. So it's just like, it's the blind leading the blind. You know, pashanapi na pashati. Even though they're seeing this inevitable suffering, this inevitable death is coming, still they don't see it. And everything they're doing in the material world is like that. They're just trying desperately to enjoy. And Chitraketu was so much in that, he's thinking that if I just have a son, I'll be so happy. And Angira Muni is telling him, no, you won't. You won't be happy. You'll suffer. He's, oh, no, he's, you know, he's just dismissing it. And the Mahabharata's the same thing. In so many places you can read stories like this where the rishis, because the nature of a rishi is they give their life for the benefit of others. Their whole life is dedicated. Just like we see the sages of Navasharanya, they were gathered there to perform a 1,000-year sacrifice for the benefit of everyone. Not for their own benefit. It's like when you're doing a fire yaga, the mantra you chant, idam Krishna, idam namama. This is for Krishna, it's not for me. You know, a Brahmin doesn't do things for his own benefit. A Brahmin does things for the welfare of others. So we see in Mahabharata, you know, all the great rishis, Deva, Asita, Narada, Vyas, they would regularly come before into the court of the Kauravas and tell them, if you do this, you're going to suffer. And Duryodhana, Dhritarashtra, Karna, you know, they all just didn't hear. You know? They were just telling, and they were telling him in so many ways how you're suffering. You know, like Duryodhana was told so many times, if you follow this course, your whole dynasty will be destroyed. And he wasn't interested in that. All he was interested in is the fact, I'm going to enjoy. I will be the king. I will hold on to this. You know, he had the kingdom and he didn't want to let go. He wasn't prepared to give anything up to the Pandavas because he hated them so much. And we see, he didn't follow the advice of the great rishis, and therefore he suffered. And that's another interesting lesson that we can learn from here. If we attentively listen to the words of Shastra, to the words of the great teachers, the acharyas, you know, the rishis, things like this, and take the message to heart, then there's great benefit to be had. Just like we see that with Chitraketu, he heard from his son, Harshashoka, well, his so-called son, by the grace of Narad Muni. So Narad Muni had blessed this child that he would be able to speak the absolute truth to Chitraketu. And Chitraketu was so much immersed in lamentation that he was shocked out of the lamentation by this whole sequence of events. And he was in a situation where he was ripe to hear the message that was coming from Narad Muni through his son. And therefore he took it to heart and immediately he gave up material activities. It was such a quick transition from being a completely materialistic person to being a devotee. Such a quick transition. But we often see that is when people are in this, you know, Krishna explains that in the Gita, the four types of pious people, they come to him. And one of those is the person who's suffering. You know, so you know, the person who's suffering this material world is often willing to give up things because they have this concept that actually everything in the world is suffering, there's nothing to be enjoyed here. And obviously, Chitraketu was feeling very much like that, that there's nothing to be had here anymore. You know, everything I wanted is useless. And interestingly enough, it is all the co-queens, they also, the ones who had poisoned the child, they went and performed the series. They just gave up all desire to have children, all desire to enjoy, and they just gave practice devotional service. So it had a very, very powerful, a very galvanizing effect on all of the residents of the palace, this event, and especially the fact that, you know, Narad Muni came there. Narad Muni is a very interesting personality, because often we see that he uses many different ways of, you know, like allegories and so many different ways he'll use to help living entities who are ready to understand the process of devotional service. Even we see with when Krishna appeared in Mathura, that then he came to Kamsa. You know, he was, before Krishna appeared actually, he was coming to Kamsa, and he's telling, no, this could be the one, this could be the one. He kept telling, this could be the one. Because he knew it wasn't, but he wanted just to accelerate Krishna's appearance, because then he knew the Kamsa would be destroyed. So sometimes we see that Narad Muni, there's all types of things he will do for the benefit of the living entity, to help them to come to the process of Krishna consciousness. And also we see in this pastime that Krishna made the arrangement where Parvati cursed Chitraketu so that he would come back to Godhead more quickly. Because if it hadn't been for the curse, he could have spent, you know, a lot more time in the material world. But Krishna wanted him to come back quickly. He wanted him to finish his business here and come back quickly. And this is part of the reason why Chitraketu didn't counter curse Parvati, because he understood that. And we see with the Pandavas, the same thing. They understand that all these things that happen are coming by the arrangement of Krishna. Like, so many things happen to the advanced devotees. They don't say, oh, why is it happening to me? I mean, how often do we hear people say, oh, why did this happen to me? You know, why did this person do this to me? Why doesn't he like me? Why doesn't she like me? Oh, they did this to me. That means they don't like me. No, it's just... I remember speaking with Peter Burwash many years ago, and he was telling me about a conversation he had with Prabhupada. He only met Prabhupada once, but, you know, the instructions that Prabhupada gave him really stuck. I think he spoke with him for a few hours. And one of the things that he said to me, which really stuck with me, is Srila Prabhupada said, don't hate the instrument of your karma. Because whatever happens to us is by, you know, our own endeavor, it's by our own past activities. So Prabhupada said, don't hate that instrument, because it's just coming to you through someone else, that's all. It can also happen by the arrangement of the divine, it can happen by the arrangement of the material nature. But it just so happens that it comes through a particular person. But don't hate them for that, just accept that it's just come. And there's a really interesting verse in the 10th canto, Tatendo Kampam Susamikshamano, Bunjane Vatmakripavivakam, Ridbhagavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavavav he's patiently offering his respectful obeisance to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all the while suffering the reactions of his past deeds and misdeeds. He understands this is all coming back by Krishna's mercy, and actually he understands he should suffer so much more. But by Krishna's arrangement, he's just reduced it to a token to remind us that this is not my place. I'm not meant to be, you know, trying to enjoy here. I'm actually a servant of Krishna. So in Chitraketu's example, you know, we see that Krishna's made this arrangement where Parvati has cursed him just to accelerate his process of going back to Godhead. Yeah. And Chitraketu, we see here, he's come and he's with his head. In the verse, it describes how with his head he's accepted this. He's bowed his head. I just accept, you know, that whatever comes is Krishna's arrangement. I'm not bothered by it. I mean, if someone cursed me, I'd probably get quite disturbed by it. You know, I might try to, you know, I'm not going to counter curse them, but in this day and age, Brahmins don't really have that much potency to curse anyhow. There's a story in the Mahabharata towards the end of the Mahabharata when Yudhisthira, you know, after the war, when Yudhisthira goes back into Hastinapur, and all the Brahmins are there and they're offering glorification to Yudhisthira and welcome him back and things like that, and there's time for the coronation, the Ashwamedha and things like that, and there's all the Brahmins are gathered there, and, you know, because he's asking the Brahmins for their blessings, and then one Brahmin, so-called Brahmin, comes forward. He's actually a Charvak, an Asura who's in disguise as a Brahmana, and he starts to chastise Yudhisthira and saying, you know, you actually deserve to die, you don't deserve to have the kingdom, stuff like that. And then Yudhisthira, again, Vaishnava demonstrating his qualities. And for me, this is the greatest lesson we can learn from this story, is the quality of a Vaishnava. He bows his head and he said, "Yes, you are right. I will not live for much longer." He just bows his head and accepts that. And then the rishi, or the Brahmins, they say, "This is not a Brahmin." You know, because some of the rishis, because of their potency, they can actually see he was an atheist or an asura in disguise. He says, "This is Charvak, the asura," and they all pull their brahmins and they're like, "Hun," and the guy dropped dead. Just on the spot, he dropped dead. You know, and I thought, wow, that's a powerful brahmin that can do that. You know, in this day and age, you know, we don't have such brahmins. Thank goodness. There'd be a lot of devotees dropping dead around the place, I think, you know, non-devotees. But then we see, like, you know, there's many points that are being elucidated through this pastime, you know, about the qualities, about the potency of the process of devotional service. Because, you know, hearing instructions attentively, the process of devotional service, he practiced the chanting of this mantra for 1 week. Can you imagine that? You get a mantra, you chant it for a week, and he becomes purified completely, and the Lord appears before him after 1 week of chanting this mantra. I mean, that's a pretty powerful execution of devotional service. I mean, of course, you know, we have the same opportunity here. It is like, you know, the first day we come, we can go and take darshan of Krishna directly. And if we accept that this is Krishna, then he'll interact with us clearly. Prabhupada explained, there's a lecture Prabhupada gave in Los Angeles, I think it was 1967, late 67 or 68, when he installed the small deities there. And in that lecture, he was explaining how the mood of worship that's appropriate for in deity worship, and he's talking about humility, and he's saying, you know, that I am rotten, I am, Prabhupada was saying this, I am rotten, I am fallen, I have nothing to offer you, but I have brought this thing for your pleasure, you please accept it out of your kindness. And Prabhupada started to cry. And then he said, if you have this mood of worship, then one day that deity Krishna, he will dance for you. One day that deity Krishna, he will talk to you. So the thing is, like, we have this opportunity to see Krishna directly. He's right there in front of us. But because of our material conditioning, we just don't accept it. We don't see it. And the tendency is to see the deity as a material object. And you know, it's quite easy to see that in the behavior of someone who comes before the deity and they're just talking about some mundane topic, or they're doing their text message or answering their phone or whatever. Now, if you were standing in front, if you perceived you were standing directly in front of Krishna, would you start answering your phone? Would you send a text message to your wife? I don't think so. So we can see by our behavior where our consciousness is at. So we see, you know, the potency of devotional service is being revealed here. And also the benefits of sadhu sangha. Because we see that, you know, he got the association of Angira Muni and Narad Muni. And through this association, he became very, very quickly became purified. And was able to completely gave up all material attachments. And he received a great blessing. You know, he traveled around for 1,000 years as the king of the Vidyadharas. And very, very. But I think, you know, we see the benefits of hearing and chanting with a proper consciousness, because he chanted the mantra, he heard the mantra, he chanted it for a week, he saw God. You know, so it's demonstrating, this pastime is demonstrating many, many important points. But primarily, it's telling us about the qualities of a devotee. That even though the devotee, he was so powerful, he had the potency whereby he could have counter-cursed him, Parvati, but his Lord Shiva points out, his real power was he tolerated it. And therefore, you know, we see Parvati in the previous purport, Prabhupada describes how she covered her head with a sari. She's so humiliated by Chitraketu's response. And we see, like, you know, even someone gets angry at you or they say bad things about you, if you respond in kind, if you respond out of false ego, what does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita? He says, "But however you act out of false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost." And that's exactly what we see happening in our own dealings with others. If we respond out of false ego, we've lost the plot. But if we just simply bow our head and accept that, okay, whatever I've done in the past, this is causing this to happen. You know, I have no business to be saying bad things or to be responding in a negative way with this devotee. Just accept it, bow your head, thank you, and move on. You know, and most times you say, you know, I can't remember who I heard it from, but One person I was listening to years ago was talking about this, and they're just saying their response when people would give them things like that was, well, thank you for this gift. Because the thing is, it's like someone points out something, some shortcoming we have in us. If we're intelligent, we take that and use that to grow. So, like, you know, in my case, I had an experience a few weeks ago, actually maybe a few months ago now, before I came to India, where a group of devotees were sharing with me some shortcomings they saw in me. And mostly it was pointing to the point of being a poor communicator. So I took that, and now I'm trying to consciously be more considerate and conscious in my communication. So devotees can, so that I respect devotees' needs, I respect devotees' concerns. So if we can take these things as a gift, no matter how painful it might, because it was quite uncomfortable sitting there listening to devotees saying things about me. But if we can take these things as a gift, then we can grow as a result of that. But if we don't take it as a gift, if we take it as an attack, a personal attack upon me, then the only thing that grows is our false ego. And that is detrimental to the process of devotional service, because as Krishna says, if you act out of false ego, you're going to be lost. So we see here, and this is why he's being addressed as Bhagavatar. To be addressed as Bhagavatar, that's not an ordinary address, but we see he didn't act out of false ego, he acted out of humility, he accepted the curse, he took it on his head, he bowed his head, and he said, yes, Mother, thank you for this gift. And then he just got on his plane. And Prabhupada points out in an earlier purport, that he wasn't sorry that I've done the wrong thing. He wasn't angry. He just accepted it. There was no emotion involved in it. He just accepted it with humility. And we see that when people get emotional about things, especially mundane emotion, of course, transcendental emotion is a very desirable thing, to develop emotions for Krishna, transcendental emotions for Krishna and for the devotees. But, generally mundane emotions degrade us. So we see that he didn't get caught up in mundane emotion, he didn't get angry, he didn't get proud, he didn't, none of this negativity, he just accepted it humbly. And this is it says sadhu lakshana, these are the ornaments of a Vaishnava. And we see that Kapila Devi, he discusses with his mother, Tatikshavakuruka Sudra Savadina, Ajita Shattava Shanta Sadhava Sadhabhushana. He talks about the symptoms of the Tatikshva, he's very tolerant, he's merciful, he's friendly to all. All these different qualities are the ornaments of a Vaishnava. And we see here that Shiva, or Sukadeva Goswami, is referring to the verses by Lord Shiva, how these are just symptoms or ornaments of a Vaishnava. So, and just like when we ornament the deity, when we put ornaments on the deity, even though the deity is already very, very beautiful, just like, did anyone notice Shamasundar's turban this morning? Huh? No, Mangalati time, not now, Mangalati time. A very extraordinarily beautiful turban. He had this, it was easy for me to notice because it was offering Mangalati, but he had this sort of spiral out thing and beads around. It was really, really nicely done. And so already Shamasundar's all so beautiful, but just with the ornamentation that the pujaris are doing, it makes him even more attractive. And that's actually the business of pujari, is to present the deity in as attractive a way as possible to attract the mind and the hearts of the devotees and the conditioned living entities to Krishna. That's the whole purpose of deity worship. It's not for any other purpose than to attract the living entity to Krishna. So when the pujaris dress the deities very beautifully, when they serve them very openly, this attracts the living entities to Krishna. So. Yeah, the Vaishnava is already very glorious, but then all these different qualities are like ornaments, and it just makes them much, much more attractive. So I'll finish it there. Are there any questions at all? I'm not sure how long the class is supposed to go for. Is it all right for questions? Ask the boss.
Who is Peter Burwash?
Burwash. Peter Burwash is a tennis coach, I think. Very famous person in certain parts of the world. I think there's a question on the stage over there.
Hare Krishna. Does it make any difference at all if by any objective standard the someone is criticizing me or accusing me of something, and we should sort of turn the other cheek and very humbly accept it and say thank you. But does it make any difference at all if it's true or not? In other words, if we take this humble position in any case, are we inadvertently contributing to the untruthfulness or the lie, which could be there? Or should we just say, well, it's my previous sinful activities, I deserve what's worse. That's all right. But in terms of the external current situation, should we react the same way if it's true or if it's false?
There's a few different things that come to my mind. Prabhupada says in every rumor there's an element of truth. So even if we can say, but you know, well, that's not true, what they're saying. But obviously something's prompted them to say that. You know, these things don't just, nothing in this world happens without cause. For everything, every effect has a cause. So the fact that someone's saying something to me, it has a cause. And maybe they've got their story a little bit twisted. That does happen. But the fact that it's happening to me and not to somebody else means that I have some cause there. And as I'm saying, you know, and Prabhupada quotes this verse, Tattena Kampam, he quotes it in the Gita, and he's talking about the qualities of the devotee. And he says that the devotee, you know, whatever happens to them, they accept that actually I should be suffering so much more than this. But out of Krishna's kindness, he's reduced it to this token. So he just bows his head and accepts it humbly. That's the mood of a devotee. So whether there's a direct correlation between the point the devotee's making and me or not is not really relevant. The fact that it's happening to me and not to somebody else means it needs to happen to me. Because, you know, otherwise that would indicate that Krishna's system is imperfect. That would, you know, if that's just like there's no cause for that to be happening to me, that would mean there's a fault in the system. A materialistic person thinks like that. They think, you know, that the world's such a mess because, well, you know, it's just everything's going on by chance and this and that. They don't actually see how everything goes on this world by the arrangement of Krishna. Somehow or other, by through his energies or through him directly. Obviously, we know with devotees, it's directly under the arrangements of Krishna. But everything that happens in this material world, like, you know, in Australia, the coral reef is being bleached, you know, and they'll try and say it's just, you know, this thing, that thing. But they don't know, you know, it's happening because of chemicals, happening because of global warming. No, it's happening because of their sinful activities. You know, they don't understand the cause of it. So even though we may not understand the cause of something, as devotees, we need to accept that this is coming about by my past karma. Whatever it is I've done, I don't know. But accept that, you know, maybe in my past life I did that, you know, I don't know. This life, whatever, but it's coming about because of my karma.
So what you're saying is that for us then, because we understand this deeper causes, and in my question I did acknowledge that I should think that's because of my previous sinful activity. So there's no such thing as injustice then. It would seem like in terms of management, we can't, I mean, then anything could be justified based on the fact, hey Prabhu, it's your previous sinful activities.
You do hear that a bit, don't you? Oh, Prabhu, it's your karma. And therefore they feel justified. But also the thing is, it's like I was saying, Prabhupada had said to Peter Burwash, don't hate the instrument of your karma. But that doesn't mean that they're not getting implicated in karma by that activity. Just like, you know, the activities of the Kauravas were unjust. Completely unjust. And they suffered as a result. But Yudhisthira just accepted it as the will of providence, of destiny, or his karma, whatever it was. He just accepted that was meant to happen to him. But ultimately we understand it was the arrangement of Krishna to remove the burden from the earth, and they just happened to be Krishna's instruments in the process of removing. And they accepted whatever came as a result, and they always just took shelter of Krishna no matter what happened. And we see Draupadi, you know, she was in a very, very difficult situation. She was, in the midst of her menses, and she got dragged in. She's in one cloth, and her hair was wet and out, and she just got dragged into the palace in the assembly in front of all the big leaders of the Kauravas. And this wretched person, Dushasan, is trying to strip her clothes off her. I mean, you can imagine if someone did that in the temple here, just like dragged the woman in and tried to strip her clothes off, our reaction. It's such a shocking thing, you know. So you can't say that, well, that wasn't unjust. That was such a sinful thing that he got his karma for it. So just because someone's doing an activity doesn't mean there's no karma for them. They may be the instrument of our karma, but they will suffer for that because they're getting involved in, you know. And it's just, you know, myself, I like when someone does something to me I feel was unjust, I try, you know, I'm not a very advanced devotee, I try to accept it, but sometimes I struggle with it. But one thing I certainly try to do is I don't try to respond, because I know if there is some karma for them out of this activity, it'll come. I don't have to be the instrument. Because if I'm the instrument, it means I'm going to get implicated in further karma. Unless I'm on the level of someone like Arjuna, who's, you know, Nara Rishi, and he's like a divine personality, but I'm not. So better I just, you know, don't implicate myself in these things. Yeah. Thank you very much. I don't know.
Narasingha Prabhu, Chitraketu's position was completely different. So he just accepted the curse of Mother Parvati. But whereas the Prabhupada says, he quotes Chanak Pandit, dead, disease, and fire should immediately be taken care of.
Right.
What do you think, just if it comes on our way, we should just accept it's Krishna's plan? That's what you are, because you have been telling us that Chitraketu has just accepted the curse and we should accept like that.
But my understanding of the point of Chanaka Pandit's making in relation to those different things, disease, debt and fire, is if you neglect them, they get worse. Yeah? And, you know, Prabhupada, he told Dhananjaya, he told a few other different devotees, he said, the first most important thing is health. Because if you don't have good health, how will you do devotional service? So we need to maintain these things. Coming in Mayapur, when I was in Mayapur, there was a change in the season, so I picked up a chest infection. So as soon as I got to Delhi, I went to the thing and I got some antibiotics. Otherwise, it'd get to the point where I wouldn't even be able to speak, because every time I go through that season change, I get the same infection, and it gets to the point I can't even speak. So you just deal with those things. But I think it's a very different situation with Chitraketu, I'll give you another example. I was listening to a class the other day, Mahavishnu Goswami, really amazing class, and he was talking about Didichi. And when Vritrasura was, was it yesterday, Maharaj? I heard it just recently. Huh? But he was talking about Didichi, how, you know, Indra was told how he had to fashion this weapon from the bones of Didichi to kill Vritrasura. So Indra went and approached Didichi, and Didichi just gave up his life. Because he knew for a higher cause, he was willing to give up his life. So I think, like with great devotees, it seems that, you know, they'll do whatever's necessary to satisfy the will of the Supreme. Because they understand, for them, as we're seeing in this previous verse, it says, Narana Pada Saiva Inakutasya Bhipati Swaga Apavaga Narakashu Apitulyata Dash. They don't fear any condition of life. For them, the heavenly planets, the hellish planets, is all the same thing. Why? Because they're always engaged in the service of Krishna. So it doesn't matter to them if disease comes, whatever. You know, we see with Haridas Thakur. You know, he was beaten in different marketplaces, 21 or 22 marketplaces, and he didn't resist. He didn't try to avoid it. He didn't try to say, hey, hey, you got the wrong man here. Do something, you know, go beat someone else. He just accepted it. So this is the symptom of the great devotees, is whatever comes their own way, they just accept it. They don't protest. They don't try to avert it.
But these devotees are very advanced, such as Chitraketu and then Thakur Haridas.
Yeah.
They just accept it. What is your advice for us? What should we do?
I mean, you know better than me. Just chant Hare Krishna and be happy. You know what Prabhupada said? I mean, we obviously we have to function according to our degree of advancement in devotional service. But if we don't have much advancement, then just take shelter of the holy name. You know? That's all we can do. But if we are an advanced devotee, then the example is there. If we want to become an advanced devotee, when I read books like the Mahabharata and stuff, I just become so inspired by the qualities of these persons. Although I read this, you know, about Chitraketu, and I become so inspired by his qualities, I want to be like that. I understand I'm not like that. I understand I've got a long way to go because, you know, when someone says unpleasant things to me, my immediate response is to just blurt something out to them, and then I feel bad about it. You know, I don't even think, I just like blurt something out and I feel bad about it. So, yeah, we just have to be really, really conscious of where we are. When I was a child, I used to watch a lot of movies. And there was one famous actor called Clint Eastwood. And he used to say, there was this whole series of movies he did. And one thing he used to say in these movies all the time is, a man's got to know his limitations. Yeah? So we really have to know what our limitations are in this conditioning we have. Of course, spirit soul has no limitation. But in this conditioning, we have to know where we're at and act appropriately. Yeah? And I can't judge you because I'm not a greatly advanced soul.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Anything else? Can you finish there? Srila Prabhupada ki. Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki. Jai Nitai Gopremanandi. Hare Bol.